From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Gentlemen, I intend to inject a 2% cocaine solution directly into Mr. Gentile's spinal canal.
My God, won't that paralyze him?
It's been tried once before on a Labrador retriever.
The Nick is the new Cinemax series about a New York City hospital at the turn of the 20th century. Today we talk with series creators Jack Amiel and Michael Begler, and with medical historian Dr. Stanley Burns, the series' technical advisor. Also, Dr. Gil Yasupovich tells us why chronic itch is just as serious as chronic pain. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new trio albums by tenor saxophonists Melissa Aldana and Joshua Redman, and John Powers reviews The Trip to Italy, the sequel to the 2010 film The Trip. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. It's easy to take the miracles of modern medicine for granted, but a new TV series reminds us there was a day when somebody had to be the first person to get an appendectomy, and some doctor had to be the first to try and open a woman's abdomen and deliver a baby by cesarean section. The series, called The Nick, is set in a turn-of-the-century New York hospital, when surgeons were developing new techniques and inventions in a city teeming with immigrants and steeped in corrupt institutions. The operating scenes are graphic, and the relationships among the characters reflect the social and racial tensions of the period. The series is directed by Steven Soderbergh and stars Clive Owen. Our guests today are the series creators and writers, Jack Amiel and Michael Begler. They've been a writing team since the 90s for television and film. Also joining us is Dr. Stanley Burns, a photographic and medical historian who's a technical advisor to the series, which airs Friday nights on Cinemax. In this scene, the brilliant surgeon John Thackery, played by Clive Owen, is about to begin a procedure in the operating theater of the hospital. He's addressing an audience of other doctors and students while the patient is awake and sitting on the operating table.
Gentlemen, before you is a patient who was infected with septicemia from his bowel. Normally, we would induce surgical sleep with ether, but due to a severe case of bronchitis he has developed postoperatively, we cannot. We must operate, but we cannot do it to a man who can feel pain. My solution? Numb the nerves in the spine between the thoracic vertebrae 6 and 7 so as to stop the brain from learning of the pain. I intend to inject a 2% cocaine solution directly into Mr. Gentile's spinal canal. Low enough not to affect the heart and lungs, high enough to dull everything below.
My God, won't that paralyze him?
Not if he makes for the hollow canal in the subarachnoid space.
It's been tried once before on a Labrador retriever.
And what happened?
There isn't a day goes by where I don't miss that dog. If you could attempt to suppress your cough.
Well, Jack Amiel, Michael Begler, Dr. Stanley Burns, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the series. It's gotten a lot of great reviews, although a couple have mentioned you might not want to watch it right after a meal. One of the fascinating things about these operating scenes is that we have an operating room floor and then this big amphitheater where there's a huge crowd watching, and the doctor is describing what he's doing kind of like an entertainer introducing his act. Is that the way it went back in turn of the century?
Yes, it was. The operating amphitheater was the way surgeons taught. And the most revered professors sat in the first row and the young interns in the top row. And this was a standard way. Often the doctors would turn around and lecture to the crowd. The doctors who lived 100 years ago, 200 years ago, were just as smart, just as innovative, just as inventive as we are. But they labored under inferior technology and knowledge.
The other thing I notice about this scene and others is the way the doctors speak about the patients while they are right there listening. I mean, Dr. Thackery here is saying he's going to try this procedure, which was attempted once on a dog, and he doesn't go a day without missing that dog. The patient is awake and hearing this. Anybody want to comment on that kind of bedside manner?
Well, I collect photography. And when they took photographs of patients, they didn't cover genitalia, they didn't cover their face, and the patients were to be were of the mindset of appreciative of the care that they were getting, and that they were basically teaching cases, so that every case they did was for a learning experience. And we see that in this particular example.
I'd also add, medicine hadn't advanced to a place where anybody assumed they were going to live from it. So anything a doctor did was simply reversing fate. And so that I think the doctors felt more free, at least our doctors that we created, felt more free to speak in front of them because the reality was always there. There is no facade of you'll probably get better.
I'd like to say something to that. That until the advent of surgery that's depicted in this era at the turn of the century, hospitals were looked at as a place to die. And it was because of the accomplishments of the surgeons at the turn of the century that people realized they can go to a hospital, get operated on, and live. And the surgeons were the ones who helped create the modern American hospital system as a result of this.
Dr. Burns, is it true that you have a collection of over a million vintage photographs, mostly in your home?
Yes, that's true. And the largest part of the collection is my medical photography collection and my memorial postmortem photograph collection.
Those are photographs that people take when? Of dead ones? Of their lost loved ones or as they're about to die? What is that?
It's both. And during the 19th century, this was a very common practice. This was just a way of memorializing a loved one. We remove death from everyday life. And as I think it was Jack who mentioned it before, this was a normal part of life. And it was only until after World War I that we had the major advances where people could expect to live to a ripe old age. The advance of medicine drove us from a lifespan of 47 in 1900 to the 80s at the end of the century.
Jack or Michael, can you think of a photograph or a procedure that you saw at Dr. Burns' archive there that particularly impressed you or inspired a story or a scene?
Well, I can say that when we first went there, the first time, the very first photograph that Dr. Burns showed us was of an African-American surgeon in Paris, and he is the lead surgeon, and he is surrounded by a white staff. And I think this is one of the only photographs that existed of this. And we had already written the pilot at this point, but to see evidence of what we had created was astounding.
This is a black surgeon surrounded by a white staff in France.
Surgeon surrounded by a white staff, but in Paris, because black doctors here in the United States couldn't work in a hospital. They would probably work in the best they could do is work in a Negro infirmary. But if they went over to Europe, they could study with the best doctors, the best researchers, and work side by side. So that's what we in our character of Algernon Edwards, that's what we depict. And so to see that photograph was just so affirming and incredible.
An important character in the drama here is Dr. Algernon Edwards, who is a brilliant black surgeon who is at the hospital, but not at all treated well by John Thackery, the head of surgery, who was played by Clive Owen. He didn't want to hire this black surgeon, but was forced to by a woman we're going to hear, Cornelia Roberts, and she's played by Juliet Rylance, and she's the daughter of the chair of the board. In this scene, Dr. Thackery is in his office, and Cornelia comes to confront him about his terrible treatment of Dr. Edwards. Let's listen.
I expected you over an hour ago. What kept you?
Your treatment of Dr. Edwards was indefensible.
No, it was completely defensible. I'll tell you exactly what I told him. I'm not interested in leading the charge in mixing the races.
Dr. Edwards is as capable as any doctor in this hospital. Likely more so.
Perhaps, but just as a shopkeeper would never stock an item on his shelves no customer would buy, I would not employ a surgeon no patient will agree to have operate on him.
Then patients must be convinced of his ability.
You can stand there and honestly tell me that the way out of our financial troubles is to hire a Negro surgeon?
Once people learn that he is an excellent surgeon, they'll change their minds.
We're speaking about a patient's possible mortality. Is this really a fair time to begin a social crusade?
Yes.
We're an institution in dire condition. We're not an incubator for some progressive experiment for you and your father's money. Please, find yourself another hobby.
And that is Clive Owen and Juliet Rylance from the series The Nick. It airs Friday nights on Cinemax. You know, it's interesting that John Thackery, the lead physician here, I mean, he is a man of science. You might expect he would have no tolerance for racial prejudice. Tell us about him.
Well, this was also an era when people were using science and medicine to bolster their racism as well. Thackery's not doing that, but what Thackery is doing is simply part of the time. This was a society that, as a matter of course, was racist.
Were there African-American surgeons in this period? And what were their lives like? Yeah.
Well, there were African-American medical schools in the South mainly, And they had their own hospitals and their own system of education that was within the parameters and within the norm of medical education at the time. But they couldn't go to major southern cities and be in their hospitals because of strict segregation. And up north, it's as Jack portrayed it, there was a, as a matter of fact, I'll go the exact opposite way, there was actually a scientific thought, well worked out, rational basis for segregation. And this was a major aspect of 19th century, I hate to say it, medicine and science, was finding ways to distinguish the races. And so African Americans were not accepted. They did work in their own infirmaries, and they did have to be educated at their own medical schools. I know one of the liberal schools at the time in the 1880s was the University of Michigan. I think I have a photograph that has five African Americans in that class, but that was highly unusual.
Jack Amiel and Michael Begler are the creators and writers of the series The Nick. Dr. Stanley Burns was a technical advisor to the series. It airs Friday nights on Cinemax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're talking about the new Cinemax series, The Nick, which is set in a turn-of-the-century New York City hospital. We're speaking with the series creators and writers, Jack Amiel and Michael Begler, and with Dr. Stanley Burns, a technical advisor to the series. The Nick stars Clive Owen as Dr. John Thackeray. In this scene, he's delivering a eulogy at the funeral of a colleague.
We now live in a time of endless possibility. More has been learned about the treatment of the human body in the last 5 years than was learned in the previous 500. 20 years ago, 39 was the number of years a man could expect from his life. Today it is more than 47. Eventually the train tunnels will crumble. The dams will be overrun. Our patients' hearts will all stop their beating. But we humans can get in a few good licks in battle before we surrender.
The lead character here, the brilliant surgeon, Dr. John Thackeray, played by Clive Owen, is addicted to cocaine. Was that common at the time?
Well, unfortunately, it was. One of the principles of medicine at the time was that doctors practiced on themselves. There's doctors who... like a Dr. Henry Head, who cut his own nerves in his hand to see what innovation was like. And when cocaine came out, it was a miracle drug. It was being experimented with for infiltrative local anesthesia, which freed the patient from the horrendous effects of general anesthesia, where they used ether and chloroform. And doctors routinely took those medications and every other medication to see the effects. And unfortunately, William Halstead, for which Dr. Thackeray is modeled after to some extent, was a cocaine addict when he was in New York City here. And one of his close associates, another doctor, died from an overdose. And they were using it to see the effects on the human body by injecting themselves, not realizing how addictive it was.
I'm wondering kind of what dramatic possibilities it presents to have your lead actor, your lead character on cocaine. I mean, it struck me that, I don't know, that sort of edgy, sort of scary focus that you might get with cocaine would fit with being on the cutting edge of surgery, you know, experimenting at very high stakes.
Well, I think what we wanted from this character is a guy who's always going forward, and the amount of bodies he has left behind is so great that I don't think he could function without something that sort of put that at bay. You know, in the pilot, it becomes too much for Dr. Christensen. And as people saw, he committed suicide. And in episode two, this is not giving anything away, but Thackeray says to Christensen's widow that Christensen stopped seeing the procedure and he started seeing the patient. And so for Thackeray, the way to cope without for not seeing the patient and just seeing the procedure was to use this cocaine to kind of keep his focus and his drive and his endurance to keep moving medicine forward.
I'd like to add here that this, of course, was one of the great issues during the 20th century. As the doctor became more emotionally removed from the patient, and the humanism is being slowly brought back into medical schools with the creation of medical humanities departments with their emphasis on treating the patient as a human being before you worry about his disease. It's not a disease with a patient. I remember going to school where, you know, I would say, and making rounds where we didn't discuss, this is Mr. Jones, we'd say, this is the gallbladder, and this is the stomach cancer, and this is the... And today the emphasis is on the personal touch, so that we do have to have that true empathy for what the patient is going through. And this is a great change in medicine. And with the amount of technology and the advances we have, it's rightly so and just a little late in coming.
We also like to marry the idea of technology with medicine. And what I mean by that is, in the opening episode, we have the hospital being wired for electricity. And so Jack and I thought, well, how do we now use the electricity in the theater? So we went about researching for different procedures that actually used electricity to the benefit of the patient. But sometimes this had really good results, and sometimes it had really awful results.
One of the things that I noticed is a lot of the scenes are dimly lit, and I suppose this is the way people saw things back then, when they often relied on, you know, natural lighting, and electric lights were just, you know, coming into use. Was that a way that you writers envisioned it?
The dim lighting was Steven Soderbergh's brilliant choice, and it was real. This was not an era when you had high wattage light bulbs and everything was lit. It was an era when this was all new and not everything was wired for electricity. And we wanted the reality of the darkness and the grit and what life really was like. Technology, ironically, helped us with this because Steven uses a camera called the Red Dragon. And it has such an incredibly sensitive light sensor that you can be in a room where two characters are only lit by one candle in the center of a table, and you can shoot that scene. It can bring more light or less light. It is extraordinary. And so Steven really took advantage of that and allowed us to see what the darkness really was back then. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's something you don't see in anything else. Steven also mentioned something that I thought was really interesting, which is that he was kept trying to figure out why there was a different quality to this show than anything he'd done before. When he was editing it, he kept looking at it. And what he noticed was that the actors' eyes were different, and it was because they weren't in bright light. So instead of dialing down their pupils, they were wide open, and it had a whole different effect and a sense of openness that I don't think many other productions have ever been able to capture.
It is interesting to consider how different the life of a surgeon is today, where there are so many specialties and so much equipment, and you do so many of these things, from back then when they were kind of figuring it out. How does that help you kind of shape the characters?
I think we just looked at them, especially someone like Thackeray, as an explorer. They were pioneers, you know, and what was the mindset of an explorer? You know, how far would they go? I think of someone like Percy Fawcett, who spent his life searching for this lost city. In the same way, I think of Thackeray in that way, that he's searching for these things that are almost impossible to find sometimes, but that he has this drive to keep going forward. And yes, today it is about specializing, but back then they couldn't specialize because they didn't have enough knowledge to focus on just a certain part of the body, or a certain system within the body. They had to first learn all about that, and we now live in a time where you can do that thanks to the men of the early 20th century.
Well, Jack Amiel, Michael Begler, congratulations on the series, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
Dr. Stanley Burns, thanks for joining us also.
Well, thank you. It's been a great privilege.
Jack Amiel and Michael Begler are the creators and writers of the new TV series, The Nick. Dr. Stanley Burns is a photographic and medical historian who's a technical advisor to the series. The Nick airs Friday nights on Cinemax. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees, now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. From Anchor Bay Entertainment, with The Railway Man, based on the autobiography of Eric Lomax, starring Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman, on Blu-ray and DVD. And from Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. This is NPR.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new recordings by saxophonist Melissa Aldana and Joshua Redman. Also, treating chronic itch, Dr. Gil Yasupovich has written a new guide. And John Powers reviews The Trip to Italy, the sequel to British comic Steve Coogan's popular road trip film, The Trip. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new trio albums by tenor saxophonists who won the Thelonious Monk Jazz Competition. Last year's winner, 25-year-old Chilean-born New Yorker Melissa Aldana, and Joshua Redman, who took the prize in 1991. Kevin says the two share a conspicuous influence, vintage Sonny Rollins. Thank you.
Rapier by bassist Pablo Menares, one of a few catchy originals on the CD, Melissa Aldana and Crash Trio. Her third album is Leader. It's her first since she won the Monk competition last year and marks her growing confidence. Aldana's prime inspiration as a teenage tenor saxophonist was Sonny Rollins. Her album's pianoless trio format and a couple of long solo improvisations speak to his lingering influence. Rather than hide how closely she studied him, Aldana has some fun with the idea. Her tune Eminem and the solo she takes on it playfully riff on some classic Rollins licks. It can be tricky paying tribute to a grand master. You don't want to invite a direct comparison. Melissa Aldana heads that off by not trying to sound too much like her hero. Her tone is body, but it's a bit lighter and smoother than vintage Sonny Rollins, more alto-like in the upper register. Aldana was mentored by saxophonists Greg Osby and George Coleman, and you can also hear traces of Osby's floating sense of time and Coleman's smeary blues abstractions. That's one way to transcend your key influences. Mix them together along with what you've figured out for yourself. Melissa Aldana with bassist Pablo Menares, who like her is from Chile, and Cuban-born drummer Francisco Mella, who wrote that tune. Melissa Aldana's progress got me thinking about a young tenor player I heard 24 years ago on a gig with his saxophonist father, Dewey Redman. The youngster's solos sounded like undigested John Coltrane, and I didn't hear much promise there. That didn't stop Joshua Redman from winning the Monk competition a year later. But Sonny Rollins had been his idol before Coltrane, and a few years ago, his influence came back in force when Redman began leading his own pianoless trios. His new Trios Live pointedly starts with a tune Rollins put a stamp on, Mack the Knife. Joshua Redman with Greg Hutchinson on drums and Matt Penman on bass. Redman catches some of the expansive spirit and expressive range of Sonny Rollins, although he has his own pliable sound. When Redman slides into what sounds like Rollins' voice, it's not for long. There's some great saxophone playing on Trios Live, though I could do without the cover of Led Zeppelin's The Ocean. And on one fast piece, Redman's phrasing gets maddeningly repetitious. Repetition aside, that passage shows how Redman is digested as John Coltrane, playing fast patterns his own way. Overall, though, Joshua Redman's trio, like Melissa Aldana's, suggests Sonny Rollins' increasing influence over younger saxophonists, partly because he's still here to inspire them. That would be one more reason to be grateful for and to Sonny Rollins. Mr. Rollins, thanks again for everything.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. Coming up, taking chronic itch as seriously as chronic pain. This is Fresh Air. If you think itch is no big deal, it's probably because you've never had severe chronic itch. You might think just scratch it and stop complaining. But our guest, Dr. Gil Yosipovich, understands that itch can be as debilitating as pain. He's the chair of the Department of Dermatology at Temple University and is developing a center for itch there. He's also the founder of the International Forum for the Study of Itch. For years, he's been trying to get doctors in related fields, such as neurology and oncology, involved in researching new treatments for itch to change what he feels is a dismissive attitude among doctors that itch is the little brother of pain. Dr. Yosipovich is also the co-author of the book Living with Itch, A Patient's Guide. He spoke recently with Terry Gross.
Dr. Yosipovich, welcome to Fresh Air. You've been trying to create itch as a separate area of specialization. Why do you want itch to stand on its own as a field?
I would say that I learned from my colleagues dealing with pain. A lot of the patients come with that complaint, and we can't solve the underlying disease immediately, but they want us to treat their itch first and foremost. And I felt that, like our colleagues in pain, that developed the concept that we first have to treat pain, regardless of underlying disease, this has to be achieved also in itch. And in fact, we know that patients who have chronic itch, their quality of life is significantly affected by it, very similar to patients who have chronic pain.
I think a lot of people don't understand that because pain is pain, and itch is supposed to be, a little thing that you scratch, not a big deal. It doesn't hurt. So give us a sense of what kind of distress itch can cause.
When a patient can't sleep at nighttime and wakes up scratching himself all night long, it affects significantly his capability of coping and working and enjoying life. So it starts from infancy, where you have kids who have atopic eczema. They can't sleep. Their parents can't sleep. And it also causes a vicious cycle of an itch-scratch cycle. And patients sometimes say, the only way I would prefer even having pain rather than having itch. And think about someone who has it constantly, day and night.
So, there's the kind of basic itch. You get a mosquito bite, you get a rash, poison ivy. It itches for a while, it goes away. You can treat it and numb it when it's at its worst, but, it's going to go away. But chronic itch doesn't go away, and it's very disturbing to the people who have it. Interferes with sleep, interferes with other things as well. It's kind of itch gone berserk. So is the problem neurological? Like, is there something happening with the nervous system when you have that kind of chronic itch?
It's an excellent question. And indeed, the neural system is significantly involved. It transmits the itch signals from the skin, where itch emanates, up into the spinal cord and up to the brain. The nerves are acting wacky. They fire when these patients have chronic itch, and we become very sensitive. So even small activities or very minimal activities that usually would not cause us itch, like changing our clothes or changes in temperature and environment or exposure to soaps, could irritate the system and the patient feels more itch.
So if we look at chronic pain and chronic itch, how are they similar? How are they different?
Well, both of them are unpleasant sensations. There's some unique difference. And one of the unique differences is that in pain, we retract from the area where we have a painful stimuli. While itch, we actually scratch it. We induce a bit pain to relieve it.
Wait, is that what we're doing? We're scratching, we're inducing pain to relieve the itch?
It's interesting. I think there are two aspects to it. Yes, there is a bit component of pain, but there is also, and that's unique, I think, to itch, is that there is a component of pleasure in scratching an itch. We find it relieving, but there is something in addition. Our studies and other groups may suggest that there is also brain mechanisms involved in pleasure of scratching an itch, and they are involving in this repetitive behavior. So it's a bit addictive to start scratching, and when a doctor tells a patient stop scratching, it's easy to say that, but in fact it's not easy to do because it really liberates the scratching some chemicals like opioids, like morphine-like. In fact, a lot of the patients say the only way to relieve her itch for a couple of hours is significant scratching.
But I thought that if you keep scratching an itch because of the itch scratch syndrome, is that what it's called?
Cycle, yeah,
that you were going to make the itch worse. If you have a bad itch, it's defeating to scratch it because you're not only going to scratch your skin and maybe even start bleeding, but also you're going to intensify the itch in the long run, and you're just fooling yourself if you think that scratching is going to help.
You're perfectly correct. But on the other hand, the immediate relief of scratching is something that that's the purpose most probably of scratching, is that relief of itch. I think evolutionally, this most probably was related to something that animals were using scratching to relieve insects that were bothering them. My ideal treatment would be to induce a activity that would be similar to scratching but not damaging the skin. When we scratch, we damage the skin to cause inflammation and to activate more of these nerve fibers. But the idea is, if we were able to induce the same activation in the brain of scratching and inducing it without damaging the skin, we may end up with a good treatment for chronic itch.
So let me see if I understand correctly. You're not only studying what happens in the brain when we have an itch, you're studying what happens in the brain when we scratch an itch and why that seems to produce a pleasure response. And you're trying to see if there's some kind of substitute we can use other than scratching, some kind of neurochemical thing that we can do so it would relieve the itch by satisfying the brain.
That's correct.
That's so interesting. So are you thinking like someday there's going to be a pill we can take that will basically do for the brain what scratching does?
Yes. I do strongly believe in that. Always with pills, you have to ask, so what are the side effects of the pill? So that's always something that we have to look into. But always you have to outweigh the risk versus the benefits. And and a benefit for a patient who cannot sleep at nighttime sometimes outweighs side effects. But we are on the verge of finding more drugs that are targeted approach for itch. And some of them work clearly on these mechanisms.
So we were talking earlier about some of the connections between pain and itch and in terms of the neurological system. So what are some of the implications for medicines? Like in pain now, there's a lot of work being done with things like gabapentin to try to slow down the nerve response so that the nerves aren't communicating all this pain. I'm putting this in really bad layperson's term, so you can elaborate on that and explain. But are medications like gabapentin, which are used to kind of quiet the pain response, also being used to quiet the itch response?
I perfectly use them, agree with you, and perfectly use them as my treatments for patients with chronic itch. They don't work for all types, but those where there is neuropathic or damage to the nerve fibers, they work very well. Gabapentin or the pregabalin, these are drugs that work for our patients. We sometimes use them in combination with other class of drugs from the antidepressant of those called selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And it's not that our patients are depressed. They could be sometimes depressed due to horrible chronic itch. But because these drugs work in an additive effect in reducing that sensitization, what the nerve fibers, as I mentioned, are acting wacky and firing, they reduce that firing of the nerve fibers, and that's why it enables our patient to sleep better and to have less itch. So I've a lot of times asked by other colleagues, why do you give antidepressant? Why do you give anticonvulsants like gabapentin and pregabalin? And I say, I give them because it really reduces the itch intensity and the suffering. So there's a lot of similarities here with chronic pain.
Since chronic pain and chronic itch are similar but different, are people who are prone to chronic pain also prone to chronic itch and vice versa?
There's not really epidemiology study to suggest that, but from my experience, there are a lot of overlaps of people who have some types of chronic pain and they're in the same spectrum of chronic itch, and they could have chronic itch. This is not well mentioned, but patients with, for example, fibromyalgia that causes chronic pain, a lot of times they complain also of chronic itch. So it won't surprise me people who have irritable bowel syndrome, which is another form of all these aspects of disease have something in common. They have a hypersensitization of the nerve fibers. And it's very similar to what I described before with a patient with chronic itch, is that the nerves are acting wacky. They're just firing all over. And that's why it's so severe and why it's so difficult to treat these patients.
You know, some people who have chronic pain syndromes say that their doctors are very dismissive. And you mentioned fibromyalgia. A lot of doctors don't even consider that a serious diagnosis. Does the same happen with chronic itch? Do you find that a lot of patients who come to you have been dismissed as having either imagined complaints or neurotic complaints or exaggerated complaints?
I agree with you, and I think we in our profession as dermatologists like to see a lot of times skin signs, rashes. And when a patient tells you that he has itch, that he cannot sleep, and I use a lot of times a intensity scale of what we call a visual analog scale and ask him, rate your itch. And I think for us as dermatologists, it's sometimes very difficult to, if we don't see the scratch marks, but the patient tells you, I suffer from horrible itch, it sometimes causes us to think that maybe he's exaggerating. But from my experiences, it's not what you see, it's what the patient complains of. I therefore believe strongly that we need to address itch as a disease, chronic itch as a disease on its own state, and understand our patient's suffering.
Now, you're a dermatologist. But a lot of the itches you deal with aren't really about the skin. It's not a skin condition. It's not hives. It's not a bite. It's not a rash. It's something that's happening neurologically, and you're trying to figure out what is it that's happening neurologically. But again, it's not a skin issue per se.
Well, I see it in the perspective of the skin. The skin is a sensory organ and has all the nerves. And the patient come because they think that the dermatologists have to solve it. And it's interesting, I don't want to be critical of my colleagues in neurology, but very few neurologists are interested in some of those sensations. I would say that I think one of the purposes of putting itch as a focus of my work is to raise awareness among other specialties that they have to address this topic, including my colleagues in neurology. including other experts, even pain experts, that they have to understand that sometimes patients have both pain and itch, like post shingles, and they sometimes would dismiss the patient and say, oh, if you have itch, I'm not bothered with it, but we just want to deal with pain. But I see that as part of the same spectrum.
Dr. Yosipovich, thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gil Yosipovich chairs the Department of Dermatology at Temple University and is the co-author of Living with Itch, A Patient's Guide. Coming up, John Powers reviews the sequel to British comic Steve Coogan's film The Trip. This is Fresh Air. The largely improvised 2010 film The Trip featured British comics Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon trying to out-funny each other as they traveled around northern England. Its sequel, The Trip to Italy, reunites Coogan, Brydon, and the film's director, Michael Winterbottom. Our critic at large, John Powers, has this review.
Back in the 90s, there was a Hollywood comedy. I can't remember which one, I'm afraid. That became a surprise hit. Afterwards, the movie's producer had this great line. He said, if we'd known it was going to be so popular, we would have tried to make it good. You can sense some of that same reasoning behind the extremely enjoyable new movie, The Trip to Italy, starring British comedy giant Steve Coogan, probably best known here for Night in the Museum and Philomena, and his pal Rob Brydon, a comic and impressionist who's famous in Britain. It's the follow-up to The Trip, a 2010 film that was basically a chopped-down BBC series in which Coogan and Brydon, playing heightened versions of themselves, drove around the British countryside, eating at posh restaurants, making fun of each other, and trying to top one another's impressions of Sean Connery and Al Pacino. The Trip to Italy is basically the same thing, but this time Coogan, Brydon, and director Michael Winterbottom knew in advance it would be released as a movie. And not just any movie, but the sequel to a movie many viewers loved. Which meant they ought to try to make the new one better. For as Coogan and Brydon discuss early on, the only sequel most people genuinely admire is The Godfather, Part 2. In many ways, The Trip to Italy is better than the original. It's more carefully shot, more neatly structured, and certainly more picturesque. I mean, there will always be an England and all that, but if I'm looking for dazzling landscapes, I'll take Italy over England. If I want to see ruins, you can't beat Italian. And if I simply must watch food porn, which I personally find even more tiresome than actual pornography, I'd rather ogle Mediterranean shellfish than the fussy dishes at some twee English inn. What made the first film click was Coogan and Brydon's competitive camaraderie. Back then, the more successful Coogan also seemed the lonelier and darker. Brydon came off as the nicer guy. This flips a bit in The Trip to Italy. Coogan is gloomier, but also warmer. He's haunted by the skulls he encounters in the catacombs of Naples, whose antidote he seeks by reaching out to his son. Meanwhile, Brydon seems more ambitious, seeking out Byron and Shelley's old haunts for a newspaper piece, auditioning via computer for a Michael Mann film, and though married, being tempted by a pretty young woman. Of course, in changing things up in a sequel, you don't want to forget what people loved in the first place. With the Trip movies, that means leaving plenty of space for Coogan and Brydon to make fun of Michael Bublé, impersonate each of the James Bonds, and compare impressions in a mimics version of dueling banjos. Here, Brydon tells Coogan to do his Michael Caine, then before Coogan can get a word in, starts doing Caine himself. Soon, Coogan joins in.
Did you see him in The Dark Knight Rises? And his voice gets even more emotional than it's ever done in the past before.
I don't want to bury you, Batman. I will not put you into the ground in a little box. I will not do it, Master Bruce. I will not do it.
I'm not going to bury another Batman.
Another Batman? How many Batmans has he been burying? How many are there? I've buried 14 Batmans
so far. I've buried 14 Batmans.
And a little pointy ears
into
the box.
I'm not going to bury another nylon cloak with pointy ears that people wear at birthday parties.
With a little belt, a very wide belt that
very
is flattering to a man with an expanded girth. I won't do that to you, Master Bruce. I will not do it to you.
And I won't make the voice like that.
The voice.
Now, the trip to Italy isn't exactly freighted with ambition. Featuring lots of shots of tasty food and nifty sweets, it's partly a huge ad for the hotels and restaurants that Coogan and Bryden visit. No matter. What I find appealing about these films is their sloping, improvisational air. Their quality of catching a moment of life on the wing. As when Bryden startles Coogan with a joke so good, he can't stop himself from laughing. Watching Coogan and Bryden walk around talking, I was reminded of Richard Linklater's trilogy with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, where they're constantly yakking away as they wander the European streets. And of all those great scenes from the TV show Louis, in which Louis and a lady friend stroll the New York sidewalks chatting. The appeal of such moments is their human scale. Two people conversing about things they care about on actual streets filled with actual people lit by the actual sun. All this is the antithesis of today's exhaustingly plot-driven blockbusters, where cartoonish characters are so busy rushing around they don't have time to talk about anything real, and where the world they inhabit was generated by a computer, the better to blow it up. The trip to Italy has no need of CGI. You see, Steve Coogan and Rob Bryden are its special effects.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sony Pictures Classics with Woody Allen's Magic in the Moonlight, starring Colin Firth and Emma Stone. Opens everywhere tomorrow. From Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. And from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. This is NPR.
Maybe it happens this way. Maybe we really belong together. But
that's Lauren Bacall singing in 1944 in her first film, To Have and Have Not. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1994 interview with Bacall. She died Tuesday at the age of 89. Join us.
The weather and that cold. How little.